Hello and welcome to this Discussing Live episode. I am recording this with a live studio audience via Zoom as part of the run-up to our season of Henrician drama Entertaining Henry, running at the Key Theatre Sudbury for 3 nights in June. 6 plays, 3 days, 1 king from the 20th to the 22nd of June. Information about that will be in the show description. This discussion is something of a Venn diagram between what I am here to talk about and promote and that which my guest is here to talk about and promote. In one circle, we have a new book on the life of Thomas More and the Tudor world. And in the other circle, we have the dramatic work that comes from the pen of some of his in-laws and also just Tudor drama in general. And hopefully, in the overlap, we have our discussion. And we have yet to see if this is a big overlap or whether my guest and I are screaming into a cavernous void. Joining me for Tudor Ululations is my wonderful guest. Wonderful guest, who are you and what is your purpose in life?
Hello, my name is Dr. Joanne Paul. I'm a historian and a writer. And I've recently, this week, we'll be publishing a biography of Thomas More.
So by the time this podcast goes out, it should have been released in the UK at least and other parts of the world as well. Anyone listening to the future, of course, it's been out for ages. I mean, years, maybe, possibly. But perhaps,
decades.
Yeah. In fact, the authoritative tome on the subject. I'm going to start with a little reading. William Roper's account of a young Thomas More. This Thomas More, after he'd been brought up in the Latin tongue, was, by his father's procurement, received into the house of the right reverend, wise, and learned prelate, Cardinal Morton, where, though he was young of years, yet he, at Christmastide, suddenly step up in among the players, and never studying for the matter, make a part of his own there presently among them, which made the lookers-on more sport than all the players beside. And that's a quote that covers, shall we say, the beginning of his life and also the end of his life quite neatly. So, story about a young man, also the story of his mythologizing. So, how true do we think any of that is?
Well, the setup is certainly true. Thomas More was in the household of Cardinal John Morton, who was the Lord Chancellor. He entered probably about the age of 12, the time that other young men, boys, would be finding apprenticeships and beginning their training for the wider world. He did almost certainly enter that household by his father's procurement, as Roper puts it. His father, John More, who was a lawyer, uses his legal connections. And I think we are able to figure out what those connections were. I won't bore you with them, but he's able to use his legal connections in order to get his son into that position. Where it starts to get a little bit less trustworthy, shall we say, is this central role that Thomas More seems to be playing in the household and indeed playing as a player as well. Thomas More would have entered the household as a servant. A household like that would have many young servants who are playing all sorts of roles. Sorry, I keep using the metaphor. I don't mean to. Who are performing all sorts of functions within the household. Roper suggests that More was waiting on table. That's possible. It's quite a privileged position, but he may have been doing that. And that it's in that function that he is then participating in these plays. Certainly, pageants plays would have been performed at Lambeth, where Morton, his palace, and we know, for instance, the Medwall was there, probably when Thomas More was there as well. And so we can identify certain plays that may have been performed at Lambeth and that Thomas More, in his position as a servant, may have seen. It's unlikely but not impossible that he played some role in them. Or as Roper suggests, that there's this sort of impromptu, improvised contribution from the young More. I suspect that that's actually layers of metaphor and, as you say, a sort of foreshadowing and speaks to the way in which More himself used the idea of the stage play as a metaphor, as a figure for the role that a counselor might play in the court. And it says something about more skills as a rhetorician at a young age, as opposed to necessarily being something that happened to him as a boy.
Yes, because you mentioned Medwall. So Henry Medwall wrote two plays that we have that are associated with Morton's household at the time. It's the early years of the reign of Henry Tudor. The new power powers are in place in various places, and we have two plays that survive. We have Fulgence and Lucrece, and we have Nature. And the one that sort of matches that story is Fulgence and Lucrece. The play famously opens with two servants who are just serving, who just start talking about, hey, there's a play going to be starting any second now. Oh, well, how do plays happen? And then they are in the play. And there's that slightly fanciful, which we'd love to be true, that, you know, maybe Thomas More was the character known as B. There are two, the two servants don't even get names. They're just called A and B in the script. And, you know, it's a lovely idea. But possibly people retconning a logic, because of course we know about these plays because they were printed, and they were printed by Restall's John Restall and William Restall respectively, and but maybe I'm getting ahead of myself with all the names that we're going to throw in here. So he's attached to this household. What opportunities that does that give a young Moore?
It's absolutely pivotal to the career that we know that he has. He is educated while he's there. There's a sort of a Latin grammar master at Lambeth who continues his training in Latin, in disputation and rhetoric and so on. And it's thanks to Cardinal Morton that More is able to get a place at Oxford, probably Canterbury College. And he spends 2 years there. And it's while he's there that he makes all of these connections with Renaissance humanists that we know are so pivotal to especially his literary career later in his life. That gets cut short after only 2 years. It's a four-year degree. He leaves and returns to London and becomes a law student. He sort of follows in his father's students. But those connections don't go away. In fact, they're increased when he's in London, and he starts to really build up his civic connections while he's there. His family in particular are very well connected with the Mercer's Company, as well as the Inns of Court, Lincoln's Inn, which are also very much known for pageantry and performance as well.
Mm. We have a fair history of doing quite a lot of pageantry here, though pageantry at that time, the survivals for us of we have more accounts of than we have surviving details of a lot of it. But certainly that sense of spectacle, that sense of debate, that sense of engaging in questions, and it is a time when there is a real debate culture. We were talking about this humanist intellectual literary school that he engages with very strongly. What can we have a little more detail about that kind of thing that he's going to engage with?
Absolutely, yeah. So he More we know as a Renaissance humanist. That is someone essentially who is interested in recovering and teaching and sort of riffing off of the texts of ancient Greek and Rome. And of course, that includes a lot of the sort of more dramatic works and the satires and everything else, which does then inspire a lot of performance. The humanists very much stand opposed to the group known as the Scholastics, which was sort of the old guard. And although the Scholastics did still look to ancient authorities like Aristotle, they did so in a way that was what we might now think of as very academic. They're accused often of using too much jargon, of being very elitist, and of separating themselves from the goings-on in society. So the humanists want to essentially make all of this accessible, make it useful for the everyday person. And we see that in a lot of More's work. More makes arguments about a sort of civic duty, that you have to apply your experience and education to the common good. And one of the ways of doing that is to become a counselor to a king, for instance, and that's arguing against a very Greek Platonic sort of scholastic position that says, no, it's just about contemplating divine truths and thinking about things, essentially. And more often puts this in the language of entering the stage play and playing your part appropriately within the world as it is, instead of the world as you might want it to be.
And it's coming at a time also where we have the increase of printing and education is advancing, and more people are being sucked into this kind of world. And obviously, for someone who's wants to be sharing learning and debate, and being associated with printers is quite useful. So his social circle are including an awful lot of people who may be sparring with him, but also are helping to promote him on some level.
More is very of an age with the English printing industry. The first books from Caxton come about almost exactly the same year that Thomas More is born. And I think that's very, very interesting. It's very much a part of what makes his age very different. And yes, he knew a lot of printers. I think we're going to come to the fact that he's related by law to at least one printer, two technically. And he's very interested very early on in what print can do in terms of spreading this message, in terms of educating, as well as engaging in these more polemic debates.
And again, with the nature of the social world that we're living in at the moment, as we're coming to the end of the reign of Henry VII, going to the reign of Henry VIII, we're still in a Catholic world, but it's not an unquestioning Catholic world. Part of the humanist project is actually this question of what may have gone wrong with the church. Not, shall we say, as far as other people will take this question. Is that sort of a fair distinction?
Yeah, I mean, Thomas More, especially before 1521, and what we now call the Reformation, when it sort of really hits England, he's very much what we could call a reformer. He's satirical, he's critical in his approach to everyone in society who has any kind of wealth or power, which very much includes the church. The church does need reforming. This is not new to England. There is a very prominent heresy in England called the Lollard movement, Lollardy, which is going to be, I think, relevant to someone we're going to be talking about. And that advocated for many of the things that we'll see the Lutheran movement advocating for, including the translation of the Bible. And humanism, with its mission of accessibility and openness and reading texts as close to the original as you can, and understanding that and spreading that knowledge, is very interested in translation. More himself produces translations. And so the translation of scripture is something that the humanists are interested in. That will get caught up in the Reformation later on. But certainly at this point, it's consistent with the humanist mission.
And this sharing of ideas and sharing, it taking on a certain dramatic form, as I continue to push my point, in the sense that dialogue is a well established idea for spreading ideas of having two people discussing a point, or more than one people in a literary form, and that has a crossover onto the stage as well. The performing dialogues is an activity that's more associated with education, but seems to be also part of the performance tradition actually physically happening. And that's where we start drifting not only to our printers, who we've mentioned in passing, but also to in one case, they're plays that they actually wrote themselves, but also their associates who are writing plays in that sort of form as well. Shall we talk about the Rastals?
Yes, I think we'd better. We've been working very hard not to talk about them and to talk around them up to this point. So I think we had better. Shall I start from the Thomas More side of things?
Yes.
So John Rastall is Thomas More's brother-in-law. He marries his younger sister Elizabeth somewhere around the turn of the century, possibly by 1497, possibly a little bit later. And he's a lawyer, like Thomas More, probably from Coventry. We know that he lives in Coventry later in his life. And by 1509, 1510, he's also a printer. And we know this because he prints Thomas More's first text, which is a life of Pico. And Thomas More continues to work with John Rastell over the coming two decades or so on a number of his publications. And they seem to have quite a close relationship. He is his brother and is referred to in those terms.
And from the theatrical side, he's printing plays and either writing or commissioning new works as well. And John Rastell is so clearly interested in theatre that he actually builds his own at Finsbury Fields. I mean, it's not necessarily a very elaborate theatre, and it's not necessarily performing to vast numbers or anything. It's not functioning as a commercial enterprise. But clearly there's a sense of someone who's really interested in theatre and that crossover with dialogue and ideas. And John Rastell is really seems very clearly interested in sharing knowledge, and certainly about the law. The law books that he's producing are clearly designed to be accessible. I don't think anyone reading them today will consider them very accessible, but for the time, they're quite radical, I think. And of course, John Rastell also is associated with another playwright, John Heywood, who produces a vast amount of theatre that survives. For context, we don't generally know that many playwrights or that many works by playwrights. And then suddenly John Heywood pops up and we've got seven works just going, hi. And they are within that sort of logic of the kind of work that Moore is interested in, and that whole social circuit. And again, Heywood is related to Rastell, and Rastell's related to Moore. So we've got a sort of literary set with overlapping interests in both theatre, dialogue, discussion, debate, at a time when that's not as problematic as it will get later on.
and politics, they all dabble in various ways in politics, whether that's in an informal way, a sort of indirect way, by publishing these texts, by putting little political messages in them, or in more direct ways, like taking on roles, member of parliament or a councillor to the king. So there's this, these things, we often think of them as very separate. And Rastell is a great example of a sort of, he's got this almost polymath Renaissance man kind of air about him, as he dabbles in all sorts of things. And I think that's very true. But also, we have to keep in mind that these things weren't as distinct as we see them today, that there was always a bleed, a crossover, and that there ought to be between these different activities.
Mm. So Moore's making some waves. He's got people around him, a support network. How does he fare at court? How does he end up at court and rise to that position where he can function as a patron for others, let alone a person on the make?
It's really through those civic connections in London that I was talking about, particularly the Mercer's Company, their association with the Merchant Adventurers. So these are groups, companies, guilds that have a lot of power in London. And he, as a lawyer, ends up negotiating on their behalf, particularly on the continent, where he is also at least sort of nominally there on behalf of the king as well. And it's while he's there, just by the way, and then he produces his best known work, Utopia, which opens with a very famous dialogue in which the two characters debate whether or not a scholar, someone like Moore, should enter the service of a king like Henry VIII. He discusses in that dialogue his time at Lambeth under Cardinal Morton. It's also where he really expands on the metaphor of the stage play and interrupting the play and the dangers that come of interrupting an entertainment with something too serious, as philosophers tend to do. And so he writes Utopia while he's on the continent, but he also gets the notice of Cardinal Wolsey, who is then Lord Chancellor, and through him the king. And very soon after, on his return, he's sworn in as a councillor to Henry VIII. And really his role at that point is as an intermediary between Wolsey and Henry VIII. And we know from his letters that he is fairly close to the king. I think we have an image of them as friends. That's not quite accurate, but he was close to him. He was passing on information to him and getting information in return, and had all sorts of roles within the court, and those increased. He functions as a secretary. He starts to stand in for Wolsey, especially as Wolsey begins to lose his hold on power, so that by 1529, More, in fact, replaces Cardinal Wolsey as Lord Chancellor, which is the most powerful political role under the king himself. And from that position has the power to assign offices and certainly to hand out cash to support artists of all stripes. Holbein, for instance, gets some of his first commissions in England from Thomas More.
Do we get a sense, and this is a thought that's just occurred to me, so we've got no prep on this. I'm just wondering, in terms of someone who's playing with so many ideas and sharing ideas on his rise to power, how do those thoughts change as he gets power? How flexible is he over time? Because I get the impression that as time goes on, his critique is much harsher about certainly the rise of an evangelical movement and things like that. But just generally in terms of ideas, does he harden over time?
This is a really relevant and interesting question, and one that I think is hotly debated. I take the stance that it's a little bit of both. Having spent a long time with his ideas and read everything he ever wrote more than twice, I am of the opinion that he has a few very central ideas and beliefs that he sticks to, that don't really change, that he adheres to. And I think he does partly because he just really, really believes them, but also because from sort of 1523 onwards, he knows that there are people watching him for inconsistencies, and that the arguments that he makes will hold less water, will be less persuasive if he's seen to be wishy-washy on some of these fundamental ideas. That being said, there are profound shifts in, I would say, not his thoughts, but maybe the direction or the emphasis of his thoughts, especially with what we now know as the Reformation. He goes from somebody who is critical of the undue authority of kings, for instance, of the Pope, of bishops, of so on, to someone who is critical of those who don't take that authority seriously enough. But his central beliefs around the importance of community, the dangers of individualistic pride, of the falsities of things like wealth and social status, those things stay the same. They just get articulated in different ways. What I really like about your question is the idea of not just these contextual shifts, but whether his own rise to power, whether that changes his ideas. I think that's fascinating. I don't think we really get a chance to see that, partly because we don't get another utopia.
No.
We don't have something that we can compare in that way. His writings become polemics about the Reformation, and then towards the end, religious meditations. And so we don't get him returning in a very clear way to those ideas that he had before he'd entered the service of the king, for instance. So it's difficult.
Yeah, and I suppose also the stakes at play with the debate shift as well. There's the Reformation sort of goes from being, well, maybe we need to reform some aspects of the church, to the king wants to get this thing and maybe he should be in charge, and hang on. Simplifying the scale of the Reformation there, and a few lines. Maybe as a contrast, because we haven't mentioned him yet. I've got it in, with an exclamation mark in my notes. We haven't mentioned Erasmus. I suppose we should, as a, as another thinker who's working in the same sort of area, in the same sort of fields, who he is in conversation with. Perhaps it is. Could you speak briefly about his relationship with Erasmus, who Erasmus was, and sort of their similarities or differences at the time as another writer on a certain similar idea track, as it were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Erasmus, like More, is a reformer. He's a critic of the sort of excesses of the society in which he lives. He's More's senior by a decade or two. They meet for the first time in 1499. It's a bit of a meet-cute. It doesn't start off so well. They kind of go from enemies to friends. But within a few years, they're corresponding regularly. They're collaborating on works together. They produce some translations of the satirist Lucian, for instance. He writes a satire that can either be translated of Praise of Folly or Praise of More, right? So there's, you know, they're playing with all sorts of things. And there's this elaborate performance. Their letters are printed. There's a performance of friendship that's going on as well, because Erasmus is in many ways the leading light of the Northern Renaissance of the humanists of England and Northern Europe. He, however, is very much of the mind of sort of stepping back from politics. He critiques More at various points for getting caught up in politics, for abandoning the muses, for being sort of washed about on the sea of state and so on and so forth. So he has a very different perspective to More on what one should do with one's learning. Again, some of that is performance. He's always begging for jobs from princes and the like. But that at least is the view that he articulates. Erasmus also famously produces a new translation of the New Testament, which is then picked up by a lot of Lutheran scholars and translated into vernaculars. And he is thought to be someone who would be, in fact, there's all these letters in sort of late, from about 1517 to the early 1520s, where Erasmus has to go, no, I'm not Martin Luther, right? It isn't actually secretly me. I'm not writing these texts. He's a separate guy, and he's German, and he's over there. Right, and I'm not friends with him, and I'm not, you know, he has to disassociate himself, because Luther's ideas, at least at first, seem so consistent with what Erasmus is up to that everyone thinks that they're either the same person or in cahoots. And Erasmus doesn't ever engage in the religious debates to the level that More does, but he is keen to disassociate himself from Lutheranism.
And Erasmus is, as again, he's in the culture at the time. He's being printed and circulated. And again, there is dialogue form going on there. And I'm going to, again, wing us back to plays of the period. So John Hayward, who I mentioned earlier, who's sort of in-law, and John Rastall are producing dialogues very much in that sort of school and that sort of vein. And perhaps dancing between those two extremes, to borrow for a thought from Professor Greg Walker, who's been on the pod many times to talk about John Hayward, Hayward is playing with those ideas of the problems of the church. He does a rather wonderful play called The Pardoner and the Friar, where, possibly based on an actual true story, where a pardoner and a friar have effectively booked the same church to speak and beg for alms, and then end up having a massive fight over who has the right to beg for more money, and which of the other is the more hypocrite. Their debate play, certainly John Hayward's debate plays, are very much in that school, but trying to do it in a dynamic and performative way, in a way that More is considerably more literally than that. But they were all part of the same set of people. They're all part of the same printers, the same support system. And of course, once we get into the 1530s, the legs of that support system start getting knocked out, because John Rastall goes over to the other side, as it were, of the confession. So suddenly both John Hayward and Moore lose a significant support in their sort. That said, John's son, William, is still staying on their side, but for other reasons is possibly not able to help in the printing of things. Mm. So that sense of they have a set that are quite established, and then incredibly quickly everything changes around them and the whirl of politics. I spoke a lot there. That wasn't really a question. Continue that thought.
Absolutely. I mean, John Rastall so there's a suggestion that he sort of flirted with Lollardy when he was in Coventry. He's an executor on a will that includes an English Bible. So there's a suggestion that he might have always had that sort of inclination, or at least was open to it, but certainly writes against Lutherans and prints against Lutherans and publishes Moore's works against Lutheranism up until the point where he's convinced otherwise. And I think Thomas Moore takes it a little bit personally, I think, when he loses John to Lutheranism. Rastall is probably converted by someone named Frith, and Moore writes against Frith in very strong terms. I think they had a decades-long kinship and friendship and everything else, and to lose John to what he thinks is a heresy that will destroy the world really, really affects him. And then, as you say, in practical terms, it hampers him to a certain extent as well, though there is William Rastall, his nephew, who is able to print some of his later works and makes a significant contribution to Moore's legacy as well. But this is at a time, as you say, when the ground is really shifting beneath Moore's feet. He had started criticizing Luther and his followers on behalf of Henry VIII. And by the time we hit the 1530s, Henry VIII is spouting ideas that sound a lot like the Lutherans. He is entertaining the idea of bringing certain Lutherans sort of on board. He has people like Cromwell, who's almost certainly an evangelical, is playing a prominent role, an increasingly prominent role in his court, and so on and so forth. And so by the time that Thomas Moore resigns in 1532, after the submission of the clergy and Henry VIII taking on the supremacy of the church in England, it's all changed for Moore. And when he continues to write after his resignation, you know, he starts off writing against really enemies of the crown. Mm. And by the mid-1530s, he's writing against people who are often in its employ, you know, who are agents of the government. But he's making the same arguments. It's just that everything shifted around him.
And, you know, a figure like Thomas Cromwell, who's come much more into prominence of late, to a degree does also courts drama in a much more active way than you get the impression that Moore slightly, you know, his in-laws are doing it, but he's not necessarily engaging with it in the same way. But Cromwell explicitly is supporting players, and a writer like John Bale is able to produce a lot of works, some of which survives, some of which we will be performing, as well as John Hayward. The explicit plug here is the second show of our season is basically that shift. And I just wonder, is what happens in the 1530s a shift from a healthy debate to people shouting at each other their much more fixed and polarized positions? I'm not necessarily trying to make a political statement about anything that has anything to do with our times, but I'm just wondering about the nature of what's happening as we shift away perhaps from debate to something more aggressive. Is that fair? You can say no, because I am just now playing with ideas.
Yeah, I think that there is certainly some truth to that. I mean, I think what really shifts is, as you said earlier, the stakes of it all are much higher. Whereas before, one could debate these ideas and espouse these ideas and play with those ideas, and many did, including Erasmus and to a lesser extent Moore. Now there had always been a charge of heresy, but now that that was being deployed much more readily, and by the time that Moore becomes Lord Chancellor, Lutheran heretics are being put to the stake and burned in England, including under Moore's chancellorship, and three of which Moore has direct contact with and interrogates himself. So the stakes get much higher, and so in that context, it's difficult to have a debate. And of course, the stakes get higher on the other side as well, because as Moore is writing, and certainly by the time he's imprisoned in 1534, words become treason in a way that they hadn't been before. It had been treason to plan to talk about killing the king. But, you know, really only if you look like you were going to take action. Now it was is treason just to suggest that he didn't deserve his titles, that he wasn't supreme head of the church in England, that the succession wasn't quite right. And, you know, that these words could now have you executed for treason. So the way in which debates could happen, you know, I don't want to start talking about free speech or anything like that, because that doesn't really, you know, work in that context, but the limits to what you could say had increased, and the punishment for saying the wrong thing was much more real.
And I've been careful during this chat to not try to play, you know, was he a good person, was he a bad person, because reputations shift over time, and we were sort of in a Cromwell ascendancy at the moment, but you know, if we were talking 40 years ago, we would be a sort of Thomas More in ascendancy, and you know, skipping over he dies, his afterlife. Because he you know, his story and Cromwell's story are very quickly dramatized. Both of them get plays, possibly more plays than survive, so we have a play on Thomas More's life, which, you know, along with Cromwell, are quite famously plays where A, the king doesn't turn up, and B, the Reformation sort of happens in passing in one scene. And that everyone's terribly coy about not mentioning what is it exactly that Moore's not signing. But both of them are sort of sold as actually quite hearty, well-met fellows who are jolly nice. And then just some politics happens and it's all terribly awkward. But they die a good death, isn't it nice? To then more modern films and television series and books. So how have you felt that pull of, you know, his reputation after death?
In the opening pages of the book, I call him one of the most divisive figures in English history. And I think that that is true, in the sense that there are few others that are worshipped as saints and prayed to, but also at the same time condemned as torturers and murderers. Like, there's such a stark contrast, and that comes, as you say, from very contemporary representations of him on the Catholic and then on the we would say now Protestant side, that get picked up and become traditions in their own right and get performed and everything else, and so that when you reach the 20th century and you have Man for All Seasons, and then in the 21st, Wolf Hall, those are presentations of Moore that have a long history and are drawing on contemporary or near contemporary sources. My intention in my research and in writing my book was, as much as possible, really to do what a historian always does, and go back to the really contemporary sources, and to look at the records and the letters and his own writings and try to construct an idea of him out of that. And it's hardly a surprise that the answer is that he's a very, very complex, complicated individual who is neither hero nor villain, but is profoundly human. And I think that that is a useful lesson for us, not only to understand that no matter people's views, there is complexity there, but also that a perfectly reasonable, intelligent person can become highly motivated to do something, to participate in things that appear very abhorrent even by his own time. And so that's been my intention. And so yes, I can't say on the good or bad. No. Both and neither.
No, and absolutely, I wasn't attempting to. Yes. The closer you get to power, inevitably in the period, you are going to do some pretty dodgy things, and that's that. The there is a question of how different figures deal with that and cope with that and maneuver themselves, because Cromwell does exactly the same thing to a degree. They're both trying to survive when they are not landed gentry in the way that other people. I mean, what's really interesting about all of the famous names from Henry's court is where they have come from, which is somewhere very different, and that just makes their life so much more precarious, and the battle that they fight is so much harder.
Very much. It's interesting, you know, we talked at the beginning about Medwall and Fulgence and Lucrece. And I mean, that play is very much about the idea of true nobility, and that, you know, that you don't have to be highborn. And in fact, being highborn gives you nothing in terms of charm or virtue or anything else. And that play made sense to perform in front of Cardinal Morgan, who himself was not highborn. He was one of they're called new men. That is installed by Henry VII. And Henry VIII picks up on that idea of elevating competent administrators from the lower echelons, as it were, of society. And he does that for his own ends in many ways. They're efficient and disposable. But for those people who are in those roles and who are advocating for their own abilities and their own merits, this idea of true nobility becomes very important, that it has nothing to do with birth, nothing to do with blood. It has to do with who you are and how you act. And that's something that Thomas More believed very strongly in and may have encountered as a child in Lambeth Palace watching a play by Medwall.
As we said, we began where we would end, and also just that debate that happens in Fulgence and Lucrece is echoed in John Heywood and John Rastall's play Gentleness and Nobility, which we are performing as part of our season. It's very much the culmination of that question of what, you know, Adam Delved and his span, who was then a gentleman, that thought process. I will do my little plug. We're doing six plays from the period life of Henry VIII over three performances in June 20th to the 22nd of June 2025, for those listening in the future. In East Anglia, we will hope to share elements of that online as well, but that is an in-person live full stagings of six plays, which hopefully you will be interested in catching. And my guest, do plug your book. Tell us all about it and where to find it.
Yeah, so it's a biography of Thomas More. It's The Life and Death in Tudor England. It is out this week, probably now, as you are listening to it, and you can find it from all booksellers, online or otherwise. And of course, I encourage you to visit your local independent bookstore to pick it up or order it.
Well, that's it for this discussion. We have another Discussing Live in a couple of weeks, week and a half for those listening on the podcast. And it is Snail Fight with Professor Liz Oakley-Brown, who's been on the pod before and returns to discuss the play Thersites, which does indeed feature a live on stage snail fight, and why so many people loved snails. Thank you so much to my wonderful guest for being wonderful. Thank you very much, and goodbye.